Welcome to this Tuesday edition of Main Street. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. We here at Prairie Public hope you had a wonderful Labor Day weekend. Later in today's show, we'll visit the North Dakota Museum of Art on the campus of the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks. Their curator, Anna Arner, will give us a sneak peek of their newest exhibition, Stories of Place, Select Recent Acquisitions. There will be an opening reception for the exhibition this Thursday. But we begin Main Street today with a report from Harvest Public Media. A proposed Midwestern pipeline project could become the largest carbon capture and sequestration project in the world. Summit Carbon Solutions plans to capture CO2 emissions from dozens of ethanol plants across five states and store it deep underground in North Dakota. Supporters say the project would bolster the ethanol industry and open it to new markets. But while Summit recently cleared a major regulatory hurdle in Iowa, the project faces obstacles in several other states. Harvest Public Media's Rachel Kramer reports.
Iowa is the heart of Summit Carbon Solutions' proposed 2,500-mile pipeline project. More than half of the 57 ethanol plants Summit has partnered with are based here. In June, Iowa's utility regulators approved Summit's initial route in the state and the right to use eminent domain, saying the public benefits outweigh the costs. That was tough news for landowner Marjorie Swan to hear after 3 years of fighting the pipeline.
I just got a big knot in my stomach. I just kind of like, really? But now after finding out more things, it's not over. It's definitely not over.
The pipeline would cut through Swan and her sister's farm, and like many landowners, they're concerned about safety and property rights. While the fight in Iowa is expected to shift more into the courts in the coming months, Swan and others are keeping an eye on what happens further north. That's because Summit plans to send liquefied CO2 from plants in Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, and South Dakota to North Dakota for underground storage. But before Summit can begin construction in Iowa, it has to get approval for sequestering that CO2 under North Dakota.
We feel confident that we'll get our permits.
That's Summit COO Jimmy Powell. Powell says they're trying to accommodate landowners across the pipeline route without using eminent domain.
At some point, when you have infrastructure projects as large as this, it may come into play. But we're spending a lot of time working with landowners, trying to make sure that they feel informed. And then if they feel comfortable signing an agreement, which 3/4 of the landowners have, then they do.
In South Dakota, where the pipeline has to travel to get to North Dakota, many landowners have agreed. Still, the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission denied Summit's first application last year. Commissioners said the route would conflict with local laws requiring a certain distance between the pipeline and buildings. Then, this winter, state lawmakers passed a law that would make a state-issued permit more easily overrule local ordinances and zoning, while also giving counties and property owners some protections. In November, South Dakotans will decide whether that law stands in the voting booth.
You vote yes as if you were a legislature. You want it to go into effect. You vote no if you don't want it.
That's Michael Card, a political scientist and professor emeritus at the University of South Dakota. He expects the outcome will be tight. With 2 out of 3 ears of corn in South Dakota going to ethanol production, Card says farmers who vote no in November may look like they're voting against their bottom line.
On the other hand, they're clearly voting for their self-interest because they believe that this is not a public purpose. This is taking away their property rights. And God, family, farm are three essential values in most of South Dakota politics over the past 125 years.
Across the border in North Dakota, Summit needs permits for its pipeline route and for underground storage. Kurt Swenson's ranch sits atop part of the geological formation where 18 million tons of carbon could be stored each year, whether he and his family agree to it or not. He's part of the Northwest Landowners Association, which is suing North Dakota over underground storage laws.
Ultimately, we will not let this project of sequestration move forward with Summit until they treat landowners in a constitutional manner, the way that they deserve to be treated, and right now they are not doing that.
Two separate North Dakota agencies are expected to make decisions later this fall about the route and sequestration permits. And landowners in Iowa and across the Midwest are watching closely. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Harvest Public Media is a consortium of public media newsrooms, including our newsroom here at Prairie Public. More Main Streets ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in leaders and their capacity to do more good. Applications for the Bush Fellowship will be open from September 17th through October 15th. More information about the Bush Fellowship can be found online at bushfoundation.org/bush-fellows.
The North Dakota Museum of Art is unveiling its newest exhibition, Stories of Place, Select Recent Acquisitions. And the museum will host an opening reception on Thursday, September 5th from 5 to 7 p.m. The goal of the exhibition is to explore a diverse collection of newly acquired artworks reflecting on the concept of place through various mediums. The exhibition will be available for viewing until December 1st of 2024. And joining me to talk about the exhibition is Anna Arner, the curator at the North Dakota Museum of Art. Anna, welcome to Main Street.
Well, thank you very much.
What inspired the theme, Stories of Place?
So I should first explain that my position is new. The museum received an Andrew Mellon Foundation grant. As curator, then, my main task is to focus on the permanent collection, which has been growing year by year by year. We have almost 3,000 objects. Wow. And a curator, in addition to kind of overseeing the objects and their well-being and cataloging and kind of keeping track of where things are, when I do exhibitions, it's also to kind of provide a narrative framework. So it's not just kind of random selections of artwork. And so in recent years, we've been really lucky. We've been receiving a lot of new work. And so for Stories of Place, what's interesting is I didn't come up with a theme and then look through the whole collection. What I was asked to do was to focus on especially like the last year, because we've had an unprecedented amount of works coming in. That's really interesting because a lot of curators first come up with an idea and then you hunt for the artworks. So I started on July 8th and 2 weeks later I had a show. So I just delved in there. And Stories of Place, I think, resonated with me partly because, first of all, it can be defined in so many different ways. And I also think about this museum as a place that brings people together. Many of the museum supporters have been with us for a long time. I've been struck by even the staff that have been with the museum for a while, or if they left, they came back. Laurel, who was the founder of the museum, really had a clear vision about having quality artworks and balancing regional works with an international collection. So it's really, her goal was to provide a world-class art museum for the people of the Northern Plains. And I, you know, I've been a member since the 90s, and so that's something I've always supported as well. So Minnesota State University Moorhead, I was a professor of art history, so a teacher at heart, but also did curating.
But this building, this facility is on the campus of the University of North Dakota.
It is. It's an affiliate of the university, and it occupies a building that was once a women's gymnasium dating to 1907, and it was transformed into this magical space by an architect out of New Mexico that Laurel Reuter hired. So as I was delving into, I had like a big list.
Did you have a criteria that was on your mind as you were selecting these pieces?
Yeah, I think first of all, I just kind of looked at everything, you know, and some things were in crates, so I had to rely on digital images. And I think Stories of Place really started with this group of works over here. So this is the Eastern Gallery.
So the northeastern part of the main part of the gallery.
Yeah. So as I was looking, you know, I was first just kind of getting acquainted with what we had and also just kind of paying attention. And this body of work, which is by a husband and wife duo, Melvin and Rose Smith, really got me thinking about place. And so this husband and wife team, they currently live in Eagan, Minnesota, but they were both residents of St. Paul, Minnesota, the Rondo neighborhood. And in this photograph over here, which was taken in 1961 by the Department of Transportation.
It's an aerial photograph of the neighborhood.
Yes, and it's not really an artwork, but it's an important reference. And this speaks to a time period that is, you know, generally called urban renewal. And in terms of St. Paul, Minneapolis-St. Paul, they were building I-94. And as we've heard so often, urban renewal often had negative consequences. And
segregating communities.
Segregating communities and destroying them. Mm-hmm. And so prior to the building of I-94, the Rondo neighborhood was known as a especially vibrant neighborhood. And it had integrated schools, a lot of notable African-American and other notable Minnesota luminaries occupied the neighborhood. And of course, a lot of community centers, churches, dance clubs, and things like that. And so this body of work, and we have two sculptures over here, which are recreations of buildings that used to exist. This one over here is called Tiger Jack's. And my husband is actually a native of St. Paul. And as a young girl, I also remember being in St. Paul in the 60s. But my husband actually remembers going to Tiger Jack's and buying things like Christmas trees there. It was run by an elderly African-American man and just sold all manner of things. And so Melvin Smith has kind of recreated this structure as well as the Rondo House Community Center. He also produces collages. So over here, the Ramsey County Historical Society has a lot of archives. It actually has the original Tiger Jack shed, as well as photographs. So this wonderful collage, right, brings together, you know, images of these buildings that were torn down. He also tries to capture some of the people, the inhabitants.
So we're looking at three of those paintings.
Yeah.
One on our left here is a woman sitting down. She has a broom in one hand, maybe a mop bucket on the floor.
Yep.
Maybe resting or thinking about what's next?
Yeah, so this is called Summit Avenue Domestic Worker. And so Summit Avenue, for those of you who know St. Paul, that's the very regal street with the large mansions and people like, you know, luminaries like Fitzgerald lived there. And so, yeah, she's taking that moment of rest. And it's a really regal pose, you know, the way she's holding that broom.
Almost like a scepter.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that's quite deliberate. So kind of taking this anonymous figure, right, and kind of elevating that. This is also by Rose Smith, and these are her sister and brother. And so it's a recaptured memory. And then you'll notice here in the background, you have some houses, right, that almost already look like they're fading, right? Almost like it's already
being
kind
erased.
Of a spectral memory.
And the kids are in a wagon.
Yes, a bright red wagon.
Just kind of sitting, taking in the neighborhood, perhaps.
Yeah. And of course, one thing about place that, you know, came to me as I was doing research is places is not just a physical location, but it's also about the people, the community that creates a place. And over here, this is more of a collage piece, and this is by Melvin, and also kind of capturing, in this case, in a very stylized way. You can see he's kind of assembled, you know, bits of cut materials and things.
It's like a portrait, kind of.
These are also of family members. Mm-hmm. The place is gone, but not the memory, right? And so it's kind of a loving tribute to this neighborhood. And of course, I think, you know, it also makes us think about, you know, urban renewal. We're renewing and we're building this, you know, highway that brought convenience to some, but also literally tore a neighborhood in half and gutted and displaced many members.
Something that I don't think about when I'm traveling through the cities on my way to maybe Wisconsin or somewhere to visit family.
Yeah. So, you know, that was kind of one of the anchors. Now, another piece that came to me, and sometimes once you get an idea, then more come. And again, I limited myself only to the recent acquisitions, are these two pieces here by Teo Nguyen. These are of kind of Midwestern rural landscapes, and you can see they're quite vast, and they almost look like photographs.
They really do.
But they are actually painted.
If I am looking out of a farmscape of North Dakota or Western Minnesota, I'm seeing this.
Yes.
This is what I'm seeing.
Yes. And so
early winter for one, perhaps fall or spring for the other.
Yeah, and kind of an indeterminate sky, right? Mm-hmm. You know, kind of gray cast. So another kind of theme that came to me, and yes, these are kind of a place, right, a rural landscape in the Midwest, in this case Minnesota. What I found interesting is he's not native to Minnesota. This artist was born to a coastal village in Vietnam. He came here as a young child, as a refugee, and he first settled in California because that's where his brother was. He moved to Minnesota around 2005, and as he was driving from California, driving through, you know, the U.S., this vast landscape, as he was coming through places like Iowa and, you know, the Midwest, he was really drawn to these really open landscapes, right? And so I find that really interesting. This is a, these are, you know, portraits of place, but viewed through the eyes of at least initially an outsider.
Someone
right?
who's first generation in
yes,
our country.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And, you know, he had grown up in a coastal sea town in California. He was by the sea. And here we have like a sea of prairie, right? And it, at least in this body of work, which was done, one is from 2019 and one is a little bit more recent, you'll notice that there aren't people. We don't see them, but we see the structures mm-hmm. that they have built in this landscape.
And could be a home. It could be a barn.
Yep. And we see a silo over here. Mm-hmm. And they're kind of quiet meditations, and he often talks about like wondering what the life is like of the people that inhabit and build these. The other thing I want to point out, because yes, very often, you know, when you look at his works, and I actually just toured an exhibition of his, which is on view at the Weinstein Gallery, is that they look like photographs, and then you come up close, really, really close, and you can see that these are just lovingly portrayed. And this is not ordinary canvas, like a lot of artists work on. This is what we call vellum. Medieval manuscript illuminators use that. It's animal skin. And he lays it out on a table. He loves the idea of being able to roll things up, you know, if he's traveling. And he was kind of joking in one interview that people always ask him to work on a smaller scale, but because he's so drawn to the open vast landscape, right? He, you know, unfurls these longer pieces, and you know that he feels like he can only work on that scale to kind of capture that feeling.
You have to get very close to this piece to understand that it is not a photograph.
Exactly.
Very close.
Yeah, and you can tell this is done with, you know, great attention, not just to detail but also to atmospherics. Mm-hmm. Do you notice in both of these pieces? And there's almost a kind of, it's hard for me to describe, almost a kind of ethereal, almost like it's not quite there. Like, I almost feel like it's a memory as well, even though he did see these sites in person. So, you know, I started off with the Rose and Melvin Smith, and then, you know, I saw these two works, you know, again, very specifically about place. And then there are a few others where I started thinking about other connections.
Anna, while we're walking to another part of the exhibit, I just want to reintroduce you. Mm-hmm. This is Anna Arner. She's curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art. The North Dakota Museum of Art is unveiling its newest exhibition, Stories of Place, Select Recent Acquisitions, and will host an opening reception on Thursday, September 5th. From 5 to 7, Anna, everyone is invited to come.
So I actually was going to talk about these three works because we were just talking about Teo Nguyen. Mm. The other thing I noticed as I was kind of developing the theme and thinking about notions of place, you know, an actual place or a place and the community that defines a place. But I also noticed in these recent works, a lot of the artists have lived in more than one place. And in many ways, then the idea of place becomes even more important. Like, where do you belong? How do you negotiate or balance out the multiple places you have been in? And so these three works are by an artist whose father came from Nigeria, but she spent a good portion of her adult and part of her childhood in North America, Canada, and the US. She now has relocated to Lagos, Nigeria. But a lot of her pieces are kind of reflecting on the dynamics, right, between the African continent and North America, where she grew up. And so these are works, and even though they're not as, I guess what one would say colloquially, as realistic, they're a lot more stylized and abstract. She's also interested in capturing the kind of vibrant energy of Lagos, right? Which is one of the largest capital cities in Africa. And, you know, she talks about, you know, the lighting and the energy of moving through the space. And so I thought that was quite interesting because we have yet another artist who has a large-scale quilt over here. His name is Jamal Cyrus, and he's interested in the sonic territories of place. So a place can be described in a lot of different ways through materials, sounds, and rhythms. And you'll see that these are actually composed of striations of denim, right?
Both horizontal and vertical.
Exactly. And this piece, in a lot of his quilts, he'll include what he calls amulets, right, to kind of ward off evil. And so in the denim pockets, you'll see little bulges. Now, he himself hails from Houston, Texas, and part of his studio practice is very much based in research. And so he's done a lot of research about, you know, Southern life, but also Southern music. He's very interested in experimental jazz. And so he's had a lot of exhibitions where sound is a part of it. And then these kind of mixed media works, this quilt here kind of captures that as well.
Sure does.
Kind of layered, yeah. And super dynamic. And materials themselves speak of a place, mm-hmm. right? And so he talks about denim, the worker blue of denim.
The overriding color of the quilt, for
yes,
sure.
Yes, yeah. So you were pointing out this mountain range over here. This is probably one, if you want to use the word famous, but probably the most kind of internationally recognized artist. His name is Edward Bertinsky. He's a Canadian photographer, also has been recognized for his films. And this particular one is taken from, it's in Canada, and he's in a helicopter looking down on this mountain range. And as he was doing so, he was kind of gripped because he had been there 20 years before, and he was alarmed at how much change had taken place.
The glaciers,
yes,
no doubt.
Yes, due to climate change,
so
and the melting.
Yes, yeah. Snow covering a portion of the glaciers, but the glaciers are certainly exposed and easy to see, and it would probably be easy for him to compare something from years past to this photo.
Yeah, and so, you know, when I was writing about him, you know, and I adore his works, and I feel really privileged that we have one of his pieces, is that what you see is just breathtakingly beautiful. You know, and how he's captured all the color gradations, right? Where the snow and the crevices and that blue that you can kind of see mm-hmm. in glaciers, right? That's a very special blue. And so on the one hand, it's quite beautiful, but on the other hand, you're also witnessing an unfolding of an almost irreversible process, mm-hmm. right? And a lot of his works are like that. He has photographed all around the world, including my native Iceland, where we're also home to melting glaciers, but also mining fields and things like that. And they're always just, you know, extremely well photographed, you know, beautifully focused and framed, right? And of course, the printing is just top notch. And so again, you have this kind of push and pull, right, between mm-hmm. beauty, you know, or what seems really beautiful, and then recognizing something that is tragic at the
on
same
its
time.
Own, looking at this beautiful piece, I wouldn't have necessarily thought about climate change, right? I
mean, yeah, yeah, he doesn't
at a moment.
Yeah, he doesn't hit that over the head that way, no.
But certainly if there's something to compare it to from 20 years before, I'm sure it's
yeah,
certainly obvious to
yeah.
anyone.
Yeah.
We'll have more of our preview of the newest exhibition at the North Dakota Museum of Art called Stories of Place, Select Recent Acquisitions, right after this news.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota's electric cooperatives, providing safe, reliable power and committed to their member owners, the cooperative principals, and the communities they serve.
Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm your host, Craig Blumenschein. We continue now with our sneak preview of the North Dakota Museum of Art's newest exhibition, Stories of Place, Our tour guide is the museum's curator, Anna Arner.
This is an American artist. She's originally from California, now lives in New York, and she's of Japanese heritage. This is actually an older work of hers. She did a whole series of volcanoes. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be interesting to kind of juxtapose it with the Bertinsky piece. It's large scale, very physical in its texture. This particular one is called Colima. That's a volcano in Mexico. In reading about her, she wasn't necessarily interested in capturing the exact details, but rather the energy. We have, first of all, smoke and, you know, spews, and then you have like these nuggets, lava nuggets, and then literally a flow. You know, there's a kind of cartoonish feel. She is actually, you'll see these little figures. Part of that too is if you get too close or people are taking photographs, you know, sometimes too close is too close. But she's also influenced by sci-fi films, especially Japanese ones. So like films about Godzilla, right? And you have this film footage of, you know, people running and scrambling. So on the one hand, this is a piece that's very powerful, talking about the power of, you know, volcanic explosions, not just Colima, but she also did one about Mount St. Helens and Vesuvius, you know, other famous mountain ranges, but also just kind of the sheer force and the terror. But there's also kind of a comic quality to this piece. And because of the sheer scale, right, it just kind of, it's going to draw viewers in, and I hope people can see this in person. Oh, I do want to give a shout out to this work here, and this one is special for a number of reasons. The artist is G. Peter Jemison, and it's the first piece purchased by what we call the Laurel Reuter Director's Fund. So when Laurel Reuter retired, she kicked off the Director's Fund so that the museum can purchase works. And so a number of foundations contributed, and of course, a number of individuals and supporters of the museum. And so as that fund grows and builds an endowment, we're able to purchase works. And this is the very first piece that we were able to do that. And so this work is by an artist who is a member of the Seneca Nation in New York State. He's a Native American artist. One thing about the museum is they've always had a very, very strong collection of contemporary Native American art. We aren't just focusing on past arts, but also, you know, living, breathing, contemporary artists.
It's a three-dimensional piece.
Yes. And so this is actually raccoon fur. And you'll see some fencing. And so to my point that I made earlier, right, sometimes a place can be captured by the materials of a place. And so, you know, you look at it and it's actually quite abstract. You see two crows to the right and some geometric shaping. We see some marigolds, and it's almost like little bits and pieces, right, kind of collated. It actually alludes to the very first place that he lived in, and of all places, New York City, right? Even though he hailed from the rural area of New York, he did move to the city like a lot of ambitious artists. And it's there where, you know, way back in the 70s, he was quite active in not only making his own artwork, but in promoting contemporary Native American artists. You know, I want to make a big point of this because today a lot of museums are like discovering, oh, you know, we have all these great artists. He was somebody that was doing that from the get-go, and if I may give a shout out to our museum as well, that we have highlighted Native American artists from, you know, from the beginning. Speaking of Native American artists, we have a few others, including this photograph by Cara Romero, and it's a black and white photograph. She currently is based in Santa Fe, but she hails from California. Actually a Joshua Tree.
That is a Joshua Tree.
Yeah, so her tribe, right, is located close to the Joshua Tree National Park. And so even though she currently lives and works in Santa Fe, New Mexico, she goes to California quite a lot. And these trees are very sacred to her people. And they are currently at risk of disappearing. A lot of current stresses to the environment are putting strain on these trees. But she also talks about how these trees are very important to her people. in terms of being like their ancestors, right? And
the trees are the ancestors.
Yes, and they are linked to the land, right? They bring, you know, wisdom and reflect on the stories, right, of place. And so on the one hand, it's about, you know, these kind of homage to these stories of her people. It also has personal resonance. This is at a time when her father was dying, and when she was visiting him, and shortly thereafter, after his passing, she would go and photograph these trees, right, these as a source of comfort.
They looked like, and this is what they are.
Yes.
As my father's passed.
Yes. And so she would kind of seek solace, right? And she is a highly technical photographer. She would often go in, you know, very early morning light, right? Mm-hmm. Which is, you know, a kind of technical challenge. These trees almost become like beings, right? And so, you know, for her, it kind of represents, you know, multiple levels.
Anna, can I ask a quick question?
Sure.
When people come to this exhibit, Stories of Place, what do you hope they experience?
First of all, just to delight in the range of works, because not only do we have artists coming and talking about many different places.
The type of art is different.
Yeah.
The locations, the place, the sense of place is very different depending on what you're looking at.
I've been in touch with some, you know, with the university starting. I have some classes coming in. I think place also gives us an opportunity to talk about what does place mean for us.
For a university when everyone's now coming together.
Yes, yes. And we also, you know, host various events like Family Day. And I think place is something just about everybody can contribute to that discourse.
You were teaching at a university. Do students today have a feeling for art, perhaps like maybe folks in my generation didn't, I will say?
Oh, it's hard to generalize, but I will say that COVID was a big game changer. I think so many of us were not only kind of trapped in our homes and in front of screens, I think it made us miss the kind of physical contact with not only other people, you know, being in a community and in a place where you could share things, but also seeing things. And so I know this was actually one of the first places I brought a group of students the minute that we could, when restrictions lifted. I also think, you know, so-called digital natives, and they're very comfortable in that terrain, but I also think they like the kind of physical contact of materials, making things. And so it's kind of interesting that we see both things developing at the same time.
I did not grow up in a world where I could look at literally any piece a gallery has or any famous artworks online.
Yeah.
It was more work.
Yeah.
Now I can see a lot of things.
Yeah.
Hopefully they're real.
Yeah.
I'm looking at.
Yeah.
Which is an issue in this world for sure.
Yeah.
But it is wonderful to have it represented in a single place.
Yeah.
I would say.
So I kind of stretched the notion of place. I included this work by John Sonsini.
My closet?
It's actually called Apartment 208.
Okay.
I found this really interesting, and this artist is actually known for painting portraits, often of working class individuals in his Los Angeles neighborhoods, whether that be construction workers or what have you. But he also has a number of pieces that we would call still lifes, right, of objects that are not living. And so what we see here are just, it's a really simple piece, just two shirts on a hanger. Right next to it is a baseball cap.
Green, and all of our hats were green. That's my baseball
hat. That's your baseball hat. Well, I find this interesting as a kind of angle talking about place, and he references, right, that it's a particular apartment number. But we don't see the inhabitants. We don't see a lot about the space, but we see kind of remnants of the inhabitants, right? And these are just shirts, simple shirts.
They could be gone for the day.
Exactly. They're out and maybe they're wearing their uniform or what have you. And, you know, and so it makes you again wonder, you know, what is this apartment?
You
know, who is the inhabitant?
Casual later in the evening, perhaps, when
they
get home.
Yeah.
This is Anna Arner. She's curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art. The North Dakota Museum of Art is unveiling its newest exhibition, Stories of Place, Select Recent Acquisitions, and will host an opening reception on Thursday, September 5th.
We have three photographs by a very young photographer who's based in Nashville, Tennessee. His name is Lysander Bryant, These are mounted on what we call die bond, right? It's a solid piece, and instead of framing them, we put them on a rail. And if you do a little bit of reading about him, a lot of his pieces are kind of mounted on a wall like you would see in people's living rooms. Like these are kind of family portraits or portraits of a community. This young artist formed a collective called Archive South. And so he was really interested in not only himself creating a body of work, capturing the particular dynamics of, you know, the Southern U.S., but also getting other artists. And I watched an artist talk by him, and he says, look, we have history. We have people. These are, you know, this is worth capturing, right? Even if it just seems like an ordinary scene. And as we in the Midwest so well understood, we're often kind of seen as overlooked between the two coasts. I know people in the South often feel the same way. And these are very powerful. And
let me go left to right here. The one on the left is just so striking to me.
It's
a young man, I believe, on a train.
Yes.
With his daughter in his arms.
Yeah.
Sleeping while he has his phone.
Yeah.
You can just imagine that is happening a million times around the country as we speak at this moment.
Yeah, and I can't help but make an art historical comparison. This is actually a really traditional pose of, you know, the Virgin Mary and child. And here you have a couple of reversals. Of course, it's not the Virgin Mary, but a young African-American male. And it's not the Christ child, but this young, beautiful, you know, sleeping child in his arms. And of course, in a very modern setting. And you're right, this is on public transportation.
Can you imagine the chaos around her, and she is just content and asleep.
Yes, you know, completely comfortable.
The middle picture to me also is just striking.
Yeah.
Some young teens, perhaps, in front of a convenience store of sorts on their bikes.
Yeah.
Just waiting.
Yeah, and it makes me think of, you know, I remember going on my bike as a young kid. I maybe had some extra
change. The village store is where
we went. And you go and you know, maybe buy a can of pop, or in my case, always chocolate or a little ice cream cone or something like that. And they're just pausing, right? And they're in that really interesting age. I would say maybe a tween, not quite teenager, not quite a little kid anymore. And there's a kind of restless energy on
there. In front of a sign that says no loitering, interestingly enough.
Yes, yes. You know, there's no story here. It's just like a moment captured in this neighborhood. And this is quite possibly one of my favorites. We have three young children here in a huddle almost, and it's called The Vow. And they're embracing, and you have one of them looking straight out. And in fact, if you look him up, a lot of his subjects look out, not just at us, the viewer, but he was photographing, right? And so there's this, you know, moment when the eyes kind of lock. And here, you know, maybe they've made a vow to protect each other, or, you know, again, it makes me think about my own childhood. Look at that, the power of his glance out. And so, you know, these are just, you know, ordinary events that take place.
This was a moment.
This was a moment.
Captured.
We're kind of brought into it. And we don't get a lot of descriptive detail of what this quote unquote place is. But in this case, the place, it's the people, right? Mm-hmm. And the community, your neighbors, your friends, right? Your family members. You know, we made this conscious decision not to frame it, you know, like we often do. Put it kind of on the railing, like as if you're in.
It's a good time to talk about the walls. You pointed out something to me, which is absolutely true. The walls here look like they're floating, and that's by design.
Yes, yeah, and also, not to get too technical here, but even the color white that's used is a very, very special white that the founding director put a lot of thought into it. And the effect that it has, in addition to absorbing the wonderful light that we get in this former gymnasium, is that the works really pop off. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's designed to foreground the works. We're not to be distracted by...
It's not a bright white.
No.
It's not yellow.
No. And very often white can be very clinical and cold. There's a kind of warmth to it. Yeah.
Which is odd for a white, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I'm always, you know, grateful to her because there is something magical every day when I walk into this space. So I do want to kind of mention one other thing, because one thing I talk about in my text, and I'll actually be giving a lecture about a month after the opening where I can kind of elaborate more fully on it, is that some places can also be imaginary and fictive. And so we have a few bodies of work that are not of an actual physical place that you can find on a GPS or on a map, but they are produced from the artist's imagination. And so we have two works here by a Minnesota-based artist, Siu Tian, and she works in water media on paper. And she talks about being very lonely in her childhood. She was born in China, and as many of us know, they had a one-child policy for a long time. And so she had to kind of create a world of herself, you know, to herself. And so she talked about capturing bugs and things and putting them in a jar like a lot of us did in childhood, or collecting other, you know, things and kind of creating this lovely organic world. And so now she's recreating this on paper. And for her, it's what helped her survive her childhood. And it wasn't all loneliness. It was also about play and leaning into your imagination. She also knows a thing or two about how to handle paintbrushes. And if you look her up, there are actually videos. She has a really solid grip on and fluency of these wrist movements. She actually trained a little bit in traditional Chinese painting, right, which often is, you know, they use ink, pen and ink, or brush and ink. But in her case, of course, using a lot of color. And so she had a big show in New York. And so, you know, a little bit of Minnesota being put on display. And in that same show, we had this piece over here. And this is Sammy Singh. And she, too, was born to a Chinese family. And in this case, she works in ceramics. It's two big pieces. And she also talks about how not only was she an only child, but a female child. And she said, you know, when she was very young, people didn't really pay much attention to her and, you know, wasn't taken seriously. And so, like the other artist, right, she would create these fictive worlds.
Is that are we looking at an elephant's foot?
Leg, yes.
A leg then exploding up into the main part of the sculpture.
But if you approach closely, you'll notice tucked in these little crevices, right, are little panda bears and other kind of fantastical elements. And you'll also see, well, okay, these are pandas, but they're covered in red, like almost like there's maybe blood. And we see threads, red threads dangling down. And so there's a lot of kind of little mysterious nuggets, as I like to call them, in these pieces. And she also talked about how the code of conduct was kind of strictly enforced as a young Chinese girl. And this is before they moved to Canada. She now lives in Toronto, and her family moved there. And so, like some of the other artists in this exhibit, she's kind of negotiating two different places, two different traditions. And she said that, you know, if there's domestic strife or problems in that space, in Chinese culture, you never air your dirty laundry. So she learned to encode, right? And so, you know, you're looking in there, and just the incredible fluency of these forms. You know, you have something that looks like a ribbon form that then morphs into a silhouette of a human figure, and then these little pandas. And she's taken a lot of liberties, you know, with ceramics, you know, painting on top. You can see that she also has a whole host of little faces here and characters. And I've also seen online, she actually gives demos. She's kind of worshipped in ceramic circles, very young artist. Mm-hmm. And so what is this place, right? Again, it's not maybe a place that we can locate on a map, but this was a place of safety.
That was Anna Arner, curator of the North Dakota Museum of Art on the campus of the University of North Dakota. The museum is hosting a reception for its newest exhibition, Stories of Place Select Recent Acquisitions this Thursday. Dakota Date Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota, fighting fraud, promoting financial resilience, and offering local events designed with you in mind. AARP North Dakota is helping your money, health, and happiness live as long as you do. Learn more at aarp.org/nd.
This is Dakota Daybook for September 3rd. Throughout the 1950s and 60s, Americans became increasingly concerned about the environment. The National Park and National Forest system seemed insufficient to protect wilderness from incursion by business interests. Conservationists began to lobby Congress to enact further protections. And on this date, in 1964, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Wilderness Act. Chase Lake National Wildlife Refuge on the Missouri Coteau is one of two regions in North Dakota with the designation of wilderness area. Covering over 4,000 acres, the refuge consists of both water and grassland habitats. Nearly one-third of all North American white pelicans nest in this refuge. From year to year, the population of the colony ranges from 4,000 to 35,000 birds. Visitors are limited to 230 acres in order to preserve the wilderness environment. This gives visitors ample access to scan for the pelicans and watch them in their native habitat. Other common species that frequent Chase Lake include egrets, herons, and ibis. Lostwood National Wildlife Refuge is also on the Missouri Coteau. It covers over 26,000 acres. Over 250 migratory birds visit the refuge. Once thought to be extinct, the giant Canada goose was introduced to the refuge in 1964 and has made a remarkable comeback. Visitors enjoy hiking, bird watching, snowshoeing, and cross-country skiing. Camping, campfires, and motorized vehicles are not permitted in designated wilderness areas. Not everyone thinks the Wilderness Act is perfect. The Act defines wilderness as being untrammeled by man, where man himself is a visitor who does not remain. But the areas were not always free from human intrusion. According to an article in the American Bar Association Journal, the official definition of wilderness excludes Native Americans from their culture, traditions, homelands, and rights. Native people shaped the land. They managed the environment through the use of fire. They engaged in farming and constructed irrigation canals. They erected structures. It is inaccurate to define wilderness as a place without evidence of human habitation. While the Wilderness Act legally protected designated wilderness areas, it ignored the history of Native Americans who had occupied the land for centuries. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Ann Olquist.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful you have spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, philosopher Dr. Jack Russell Weinstein and I will discuss the question, does the sport of politics undermine its importance? That's all tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.